I was blacked out, so out of my mind. Those two ended up getting in a fist fight, and the cops ended up getting called. There was blood out in the driveway. This man apparently was married because he had his ring, wedding ring in his pocket, and it flew out in the driveway. And I remember thinking, all these sober people are so dorky, and now I'm like a huge sober limb. But, you know, I just learned what else you can do with your free time. What else do I do for fun?
Hi, welcome back to another episode of The Mindful Space. Today we have Emily with us. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm so grateful to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad you were able to come to Florida.
It's beautiful.
Welcome to the Sunshine State.
I'm loving it.
So today our topic is addiction, sobriety, your personal journey, and a little bit of yoga. So let's start from the beginning. How did your addiction come about? When did it start? And when did you start your healing journey?
Yeah, I'd love to share. So my addiction started from the very beginning. I actually grew up in Cross Plains, which is a small town outside of Madison in Wisconsin. And I grew up literally right next door to a bowling alley. So my driveway was part of the bowling alley parking lot for the most part. And without giving my parents labels, they liked to drink a lot. So I spent a lot of time at the bowling alley. And I actually had a pretty good upbringing. Like, I liked bowling. I liked playing the games there. Because I was in a small town, I had freedom to go to the pool and go hiking and run around and be kind of wild and free, even though I also had parents that were probably drinking a little bit too much. I also, we went camping a lot when I was younger. And so we would, you know, I would have the freedom to run around there. But also, again, the constant is that my parents like to drink. So all the adults would go drinking and then we would kind of be able to run free. So my childhood wasn't terrible. I actually enjoyed my childhood, but it was surrounded by drinking. And that's what the adults did for fun. That's the model behavior that I had. And I remember being on family vacation and my parents, I was probably like 10 or 11, you know, letting me taste a beer. And I remember being like, this tastes really gross. Why do you drink this? I didn't understand until I got into middle school. And in health class, we had, drug and alcohol awareness, and they gave us the drunk goggles. So I don't know if they did this with you, but you put on the drunk goggles and it makes you feel silly. So for the first time, I was like, oh, this is why my parents drank. It makes you feel silly. And so I had this bright idea on an early release day when the teachers had, you know, meetings and conferences and we get out at noon to invite some of my friends over to raid my parents' liquor cabinet. And me not knowing how long it would last, I just started drinking and drinking, and I actually drank alcoholically. The first time that I drank, I could not stop. I had the compulsion to have another and another and another. And of course, my mom was coming home at 5 o'clock. So when it got close to 5 o'clock, my friends, who still had some wherewithal with them, put me into bed. And when my mom came home, she found me drunk and in bed at 5 p.m. And I was in middle school. Yeah. And so that was my first introduction to drinking. And I would say I drank alcoholically my first time. So, middle school went on. I definitely raided that cabinet a few more times. I got into high school and I was a party girl. Like, I feel like I was like an okay kid. I was on the varsity dance team all 4 years, but I was going downtown Madison and partying with the college kids. And my drinking was always a little bit more than everyone else's. So at that point, my older brother was buying me booze. And I remember I would, you know, pull up the trunk and show my friends what we had. And they'd always be like, that's way too much. And I'm like, no, we need all this. So I knew from an early stage that I was a little bit different than some of my other friends. But then when I got into college and I got a fake ID and I was living, you know, on frat row, but not at the university because I went to the tech college, I was able to live in a party house. So I really had no supervision.
Oh, wow.
Fake IDs, music festivals, concerts, no curfew. I started getting into drugs. I started blacking out a lot. I actually blacked out my first time drinking. That was a huge part of my story. And things just really started to unravel for me. The interesting thing is when I first started drinking in middle school, that's when my mom got sober. So that was a little bit confusing. But she got sober. I continued drinking. And then when things really started to unravel, when I was about 19 and I stopped showing up for work and things like that, I was like, I have a problem. mom, what do I do? She was going to AA. So that was my first AA meeting when I was only 19. But I certainly wasn't ready to start giving up my party life at that point. But that's when I first realized that I had a problem.
So at 19 was your first realization that you needed help, but it was not enough. And at that point, you were doing alcohol and drugs. What kind of drugs?
So it started with cocaine and ecstasy at that point. And then later on down my journey, about 10 years later, when I moved to San Diego, I actually got into meth too. So I was doing that. And, you know, I was always going on benders and binges. So, you know, partying and drinking for 3 days. And towards the end, it would be like 5 days where I wouldn't sleep and I would just be up and just off to the races. I never wanted the party to stop. And that was a constant thing with me. I would be up all night. You know, the party would start normally, you know, going out and drinking like the college kids do, but I never wanted it to stop. And so I would stay up all night sometimes on drugs. And then I discovered 6 a.m. bars. I'd even go to 6 a.m. bars by myself. So it just was really dark and seedy for a long time. But for some reason, I kept holding on to my party life. I don't know why. I guess it's because I didn't know anything else. And I just, like, I knew that I needed to get sober, but I didn't know what that would look like. And I thought it was going to be boring. I thought I wasn't going to have any friends. I thought my life was going to be over, actually, because whenever I did try to get sober and I was still going to concerts, I would either slip up because I just said F it, or I would go and I would maybe stay sober, but I'd be miserable and I'd feel bad for myself.
You would throw the pity party.
I would throw the pity party. Yeah, absolutely. So it was 15 years of me bouncing in and out of recovery, kind of doing this dance. And it was AA and outpatient. And I even did inpatient for a few days at this low budget place and got my parents to take me out of there. And I would stack up, you know, 2 weeks, a month, at some point, like 3 months. But I just really couldn't stack up a lot of time until I found yoga. And I would say that that was probably the most pivotal point of my journey. Because for the first time, I felt community in somewhere else than my party life. And I was still having the music and the movement, which I loved, going to live concerts. So it was looked a lot different, obviously. But what I found is the people at the yoga studio aren't partying. They're sober, whether they're sober like all the time, but they're not drunk at the studio. So it was a safe place for me. And then all the mind-body-soul connection that you get when you go to yoga. So I started to feel more grounded, more comfortable in my own skin, less anxiety. And then I decided I wanted to become a yoga teacher. So for the first time in my life, I had purpose and passion. And I did the yoga teacher training and I got 6 months of sobriety, which was a lot for me because I had never gotten that much time. But I still, I think at 6 months, I celebrated by, you know, going back out. And so it was just back and forth, back and forth. And for a long time, I was living this double life. I was teaching yoga. I was holistic. But then I would still go on benders every once in a while. And it was exhausting.
Like looking back at it, I was exhausted. Now, from going back and forth, what would you say was your turning point or the one rock bottom that really hit you or that you remember to be, you know, the decisive point of becoming sober for real? Because now it's been 4 years.
It's been a little over 4 years. And I had a year and a half before that, too. So I honestly have had probably a handful of rock bottom. So just to like give the audience a little bit of a glimpse into what my addiction looked like, this is the stuff that I would do and get away with. So when I first moved to San Diego, I had met this guy up in San Francisco before I got down there and I went on a bender and I wanted to go see this guy. This was my drunken thought. And so I stayed up all night. I was still drinking in the morning and I drove to the airport and got on a shuttle and like made myself, I got to the counter at the ticket counter and bought a plane ticket. I didn't even know you could do that. Virgin Airlines. And I come out of my blackout on the freaking plane. And the only reason I came out of my blackout is because I think I was trying to get booze served to me. And they're like, no, we're not serving you. And anyways, it was just a mess. I get up to San Francisco. The guy didn't even know that I was coming. And but a week later, when I make my way back to San Diego, my car was nowhere to be found. I had no idea where it was. I actually lost it for 2 weeks. I didn't know anybody in San Diego yet. So I rented a bicycle to like bike around and look for my car. Like this is the stuff that I did on the regular. That wasn't a rock bottom. So like things like this were constantly happening and my life was just, you know, a big mess. I think I did get into treatment at that point and probably stacked up sometime, but whatever reason, I didn't want to give up the party life.
Yeah.
So luckily I actually met someone who was willing to get sober with me. So we were, you know, having sober stints, but then still partying, and he really didn't enjoy drinking with me at all because I just always took it to the next level. We moved to Arizona, and we were going to build this wedding venue and wellness retreat. We had big dreams for the future. We weren't engaged or anything at that time, but I really loved this man. And we had this rule that I couldn't drink if he wasn't around. Like, the only time I could drink is if he was there to, like, babysit me, basically.
Yeah.
And he went to California to shoot a wedding. He was a wedding photographer, and I decided I was going to drink that day. So I had gone out to like the first Friday art walk in Phoenix and started drinking. And one thing led to another. I ended up meeting a guy there and we were just drinking together. And he said that he had some drugs at his house. So and he lived in my neighborhood. I'm like, let's go get those drugs and go back to the house, who's my boyfriend's house, and party there. My boyfriend's brother was living with us at the time, and I was so out of my mind that I didn't even think that Richard would be there seeing us partying when I'm not supposed to be drinking. Anyways, I was blacked out, so out of my mind. Those two ended up getting in a fist fight, and the cops ended up getting called. There was blood out in the driveway. This man apparently was married because he had his wedding ring in his pocket, and it flew out in the driveway. I do remember the cops coming, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, what did I do? That's when I came out of my blackout again. And Richard had called Josh. He turned the car around, drove back to Arizona. He had to get his assistant to shoot the wedding the next day. I had so much guilt and shame. And at that point, I was like, the person who is drinking is not Emily anymore. Like, I have absolutely no control of the outcome. And I loved Josh. I would have never done that sober. I was really, really loyal. But the person that I became when I was drinking was not me. So I actually got a year and a half of sobriety. I would say that that's probably one of my main rock bottoms. But even after a year and a half, I started romanticizing about maybe I can just go to a music festival once a year and let loose or whatever. And I ended up slipping up again. And that time, my rock bottom was really not anything that bad happened other than me physically getting ill and blacking out. But I had thought, I'm working so hard, I deserve to drink. And really what happened that night is nothing that Emily deserves. And so I had that realization of, like, I think this is a reward, but what happens when I do it is not a reward.
Yes.
And luckily, and that was
a lot.
Yeah, it does happen a lot. Yeah, our brain tricks us that it's working for us or that we deserve it when very clearly our life is not going very well. But for whatever reason, we hold on to it.
Like, I had a long day of work. I deserve a glass of wine.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I worked so hard. I deserve to just go get hammered at the bar because that's how I relax. And that'll make me happy, even though it's a depressant.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's like a infinite loop.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, breaking that loop and finding the other ways to treat yourself, you know? And when you partied and all your friends party and maybe your parents drank too, you might not even know what that looks like.
Yeah.
Like I said, you know, I grew up with my parents drinking. That's what they did for fun. That's what they did to celebrate. Yeah. I didn't really know anything else.
You don't have to tell me. I'm Hispanic.
Okay.
That's how I was raised as
mm-hmm.
well, you
mm-hmm.
know? So how did your journey begin? What were the first steps that you took to become sober?
I mean, my journey began when I went to the first AA meeting when I was 19 years old. I had a lot of resistance about AA at that point because I didn't believe in God at all. I was very big into the manifestation, and then the book is written with he. I was basically finding any excuse why I didn't like those meetings because I didn't really want to get sober. But what I did like about those meetings is, you know, the slogans, progress, not perfection, one day at a time, easy does it, and then just the community. There's something about being with other people who are going through a similar thing so you don't feel so alone. So that was the beginning of my journey, but, you know, I went to outpatient 3 different times, which I actually enjoyed those experiences too. The first one that I went to was in Madison, Wisconsin, and it's this place called Connections Counseling. And they teach you how to do sober activities, like meet up for a hike, go bowling. And yeah. I remember thinking, all these sober people are so dorky. And now I'm like a huge sober lame. But, you know, I just learned what else you can do with your free time. Because when you're in your early 20s, a lot of people are drinking a lot, you know, and it's like, what else do I do for fun? That was a huge part of, you know, why I think I held on to my party life, is because that's the only way I knew to have fun. And now I kind of look at my fun as in the things that bring me joy, you know, like going to farmers markets and going out to a healthy lunch, or, you know, going to a yoga class, which in the past I wouldn't associate that as fun, but now it's the things that make me feel good and bring me joy. And now I associate them with fun. So
did you have to change your circle of friends and go into this new sober communities in order to achieve that goal of soberness?
I did. I did have to take a step away from my party friends. There was a few that I still hung out with. You know, we'd go on a hike or meet for lunch or coffee, you know, something that didn't involve alcohol. Because anytime that I did hang out with that same party crew, going to a concert or a music festival, if I stayed sober, then I would be unhappy. And if I, you know, went and got the efforts, then I drank and everything would just fall apart. So I really did have to just take a step away for a long time. But now I'm able to go back to concerts. They just look a little bit different. I'm not going to like the 3 a.m. raves anymore. Most likely it's like Trevor Hall or Michael Fronte and like an outdoor concert that's done at 9 p.m. And I enjoy that. And I'm still really good friends with a lot of my party friends. And actually, something that's cool is oftentimes when we choose sobriety, it'll have a ripple effect, and our friends and family might get curious too, because good chances if we drank like we did, you know, our friends might drink the same way and eventually realize that they have a problem too. So that's really cool when your party friends become your sober friends.
At the beginning, when you started to distance yourself, did you get support from them? Were they understandable? Was that like hard for you to do?
It was really hard because I did get support from them, but even just being around them when I would go to lunch or to coffee, it was triggering because I always drank around those people. And so they would be like, Emily, we're here, we're supporting you. Yeah. But it was still really hard.
Yeah,
because I felt like they were maybe like just not drinking because of me. Well, they were, you know what I mean? So then I felt like I was making them not drink. It made me feel really uncomfortable. It was really, really tough. That's why I think it's so important to find sober sisters or a sober community. You could still keep some of your old friends, but you might need to take a step away for a while until you stack up some sober time and really just start to make your sobriety a lifestyle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to self-care, how can that help in sobriety?
Self-care is probably my most important tool in my own recovery. And I feel like when we feel good, then we make better decisions for ourselves. So there is this method called the HALT method: hungry, angry, lonely, tired. And I like to add bored on the end of that. And so often if we feel triggered to drink or use a drug, we're actually just one of those things. So being in tune with yourself, you know, how am I feeling in my mind, body, and soul? What do I need right now? Am I hungry? Have a freaking snack. Am I lonely?
Snickers.
Yeah, have a Snickers. Or something healthy like some almonds, but Snickers are good too. And, you know, am I angry? You know, healthy venting to the right person, or, you know, exercising. Am I lonely? Reaching out to a sober friend, or I like to say even going to a coffee shop, just being around other people, or wandering around a Target. Good can help. I know it seems silly, but
no, I get it.
And tired was actually my biggest trigger. So I always make sure that I, you know, get 8 or 9 hours of sleep. I have a whole bath routine and nighttime routine, supplements that I take, because when I was overtired, that would be, you know, sometimes a trigger. And then bored, because a lot of people that drink regularly don't know what else to do with their time. So something that I work with clients a lot is, you know, working on what else can I do with my free time? What hobbies do I have? What interests me? What else can I do with my time? So, yeah.
Now, eating healthy and having a routine, is that important? Is that a really important part of the self-care.
Absolutely. So routine, I'm an entrepreneur, so I get to make my own schedule. So my routine looks a little bit different from day to day, but some people might want the same routine every day. I think it is always important to make sure that you have some daily movement, whether it's just walking, going to yoga, going on a hike, going to the gym, starting your day with some sort of movement, even if it's only 10 or 15 minutes, is huge, because we can get stagnant energy stuck in our body. And when we move our body and exercise, it actually releases. So it makes our body feel better, but also our mind. So having, you know, some sort of routine where you're moving your body regularly. Also, eating healthy is really important as well. So trying not to eat the, you know, the processed foods. And the more that you do this, the more that you'll be in tune and notice, when I eat fruits and vegetables, I feel better and lean protein. When I eat, you know, Cheetos and Snickers, yes, I don't feel as good. And so it just always comes back to, I say my recovery is like a feel-good program. I just try to do all the things that make me feel good. And honestly, I had a few nights recently where I had some key lime pie, and then I had some ice cream, and just like a few days in a row, you just don't feel the greatest. Okay. And then it can compound. So even though I don't really, you know, have the desire to drink anymore, for me, if I'm not feeling well, I can just kind of go down that rabbit hole of like eating more sweets and everything like that.
Okay.
And then you just kind of got to check yourself and be like, what can I do to make myself feel better? So it's definitely a practice. Yoga has helped with a lot, being mindful and just tuning in to like, how do I feel when I eat this? Or how does it make me feel when I work out?
Yeah. So for you, it was yoga, right? Mm-hmm. And you've done some wonderful things with it, right? You have the program. You have your retreats. Can you give us a little bit more info?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on Instagram, I'm happy.sober.free. And I am a spiritual yoga teacher and also a sobriety coach. So I help women find freedom, joy, and abundance in sobriety. And I do that through virtual meetings, online programs, and also in-person retreats. And so my in-person retreats are great. It's cool because a lot of women will meet on Zoom and then they want to meet in person. I started by just doing more general wellness retreats, and now mine are a little bit more sobriety focused, but they're also great for individuals that might be sober curious, that just want to see what it looks like to take a vacation and not drink any alcohol. And
that's
to
a
be
tough one.
Exactly. it really can be. And so we do a lot of yoga and hiking and sound healing and voice activation. Usually the retreats have gluten-free and vegan food, really healthy and nourishing. I always like to kind of add a little bit of adventure aspect. So the retreat that I just did here in Florida, we went kayaking. If we're in Sedona, usually we go do a hike. And I really like to just show people that we can have fun and really connect without alcohol. And it takes a little time sometimes, but these retreats kind of catapult people into just feeling more comfortable in their own skin and just getting clear on what they want for themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah. And being surrounded by other health-minded sober women is awesome too.
Do you feel there's a lot of stigma surrounding, you know, if you go to a social event, then you kind of have to drink, even if it's a glass of wine?
Absolutely. There is. My world is so sobriety focused.
Okay.
But and when I go places, I usually have a sober squad with me.
Okay.
But I remember in some of those earlier days, you know, going to a barbecue and everyone is drinking. And so it's nice that there's a lot of non-alcoholic options now.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel like there's a movement right now for people choosing to be alcohol free, whether they decide that they have a problem or they just want to feel better. Mm-hmm. Because let's be honest, most of us know, even if we're a normal drinker and we have a couple of drinks, we don't feel 100% the next day.
Mm-mm. Or the next one.
Exactly. Yeah. My hangovers would be like 3 days sometimes.
Depending on your age,
right?
You can relate to us or not.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the resources that you provide for your audience?
I'd love to share. So one free resource that I have is called the Recovery Rolodex, and it's 21 bite-sized videos to support you on your journey. And they're just like 3 to 7 minute videos that will help you through like how to navigate social gatherings, or tips for sleep support, how to, you know, manage you know, drink your drinking friends, stuff like that. Things that, you know, you can feel a little bit triggered or not really know how to do, it's probably covered in the recovery Rolodex. So if anyone in the audience wants to find that, again, on Instagram, I'm happy.sober.free, and there's a link in my bio to get that resource. And then also my flagship program, Recovery Revival, I love to talk about. And that is a virtual 3-month group coaching program for women designed to help you find more freedom, joy, and abundance in sobriety. And it's really just a holistic program. So we always start the meetings with something grounding, like some breath work or 10 minutes of yoga. And then we dive into the meeting and we work on things like self-forgiveness and building confidence and getting a clear vision for the future, as well as mindset stuff. So it's actually designed whether you have 2 days, 2 weeks, or 2+ months. Mm-hmm. So a lot of women, you know, they have a couple of months or maybe even a couple of years, but they're feeling a little bit stuck and stagnant. And so we welcome them into the program as well. And it's been really cool to meet with women all over the world, Canada, Guatemala, the Philippines. And we keep the groups really small. So just about 10 to 12 people. So they're really intimate. And we have support coaches. So you get one-on-one coaching there as well. So we're on Recovery Revival round 8 right now. And we don't plan on stopping because it's really working very well. So if there's any women in the audience that are interested in, you know, getting sober or staying sober,
Hit you up.
Hit me up.
Perfect. I loved it. Now, I also think, and I think we were talking about it before, that forgiving yourself is a big part of the journey, right? Of becoming sober and just something to keep on in order not to relapse. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
I would love to, because I slipped up about 100 times on my own journey. So I know a lot about shame and guilt and frustration and also self-forgiveness, because that's been a huge part of my journey. And so something that I always tell people, and if there's any listeners who are on this journey and keep slipping up, or for whatever reason, whether it has to do with alcohol or not, you feel guilt and shame. Well, actually, this does relate to alcohol. What I always tell people is the person who did those things is not who you are. And so, yes, we get to take responsibility for the things that we did while we were drinking or using, but it's not who we are at our core. And so if you can kind of try to look at, like, you know, drunk Emily and sober Emily, sober Emily would never do the things that drunk and using Emily did. It was a different person. I think that alcohol is an evil spirit and can really take us over, especially when we get to the point of blackout. And so if you can just look at yourself in, you know, two different people, just knowing that that's really not who you are. And one of the best things that you can do for self-forgiveness is to start living in the solution. So the more time that you stack up of sobriety just makes you realize that you're not that person anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So important.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've loved our conversations. The last question I'm going to ask, what would be your last message for anyone that might be listening that, it, you know, they might be going through the sobriety journey or they're thinking about starting one, to keep falling back on it? What would you tell them?
My big message is sobriety really is magical. I remember going to AA meetings and having people tell me, like, the miracle's on the other side, just keep going. And I just couldn't see it. But now I'm just telling you, I'm on the other side. And I wouldn't go back to my party life if someone paid me $1 million. So that's how much I love being in the sober lifestyle. I've really created a sober lifestyle. And when you surround yourself with other individuals who are doing the same thing, and you start going after your dreams and goals and can take vacations without, you know, worrying about what's going to happen the next day or if you'll even make it on your plane, it's really so freeing. So, you know, whether you're new to the journey or you've been on it for a while, don't give up and keep trying, because the miracle could be just right around the corner.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well said.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you guys for watching or listening. Don't forget to leave us a comment if you like what we talked about. If you have anything to say, we will be looking. Don't forget to subscribe and like, and I will see you next week.